Tonight on Arena, Nick Laird tries to come to terms with the loss of his father in the poem Up Late, and we review Rosalind McDonagh's Walls and Windows, the first Abbey Theatre production of a play written by a traveller. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And good to be back with you at 7 o'clock in the evening. Thanks very much to Kev for looking after the shop for the last couple of weeks. Poet and novelist Nick Laird published his first collection of poems to a fault and his first novel, Utterly Monkey, in 2005. Since then, he has won numerous awards for his writing, including the Betty Trask Prize, the Somerset Maugham Award, the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature and a Guggenheim Fellowship. His most recent books are the poetry collection Feel Free, the novel Modern Gods, and the children's book Weirdo, which he wrote with his wife, writer Zadie Smith. In the latest issue of Granta magazine, he wrote a very powerful and moving elegy for his father, Alistair Laird, and delighted to be joined by Nick Laird on the programme this evening. Nick, the poem starts, as I read it, I thought, I know the country that I'm in with this poem. It talks about, you know, I know that I'm dealing with some kind of grief. It talks about the passing of time and how we're trying to understand time moving around in our minds. There are phrases like umbra blooms, crestless waves of darkness. So I kind of felt I knew the territory I was in. And then suddenly you stop. And I want you to read how the second section of the poem starts.
Okay. My father died today. Sorry to bolt that on. You understand the shift required. This morning, the consultant said your father now is clawing at the mask and is exhausted, and we've thrown everything we have at this. It's a terrible disease. Do you want me to go on, Sean, or is that...
Please, no, go to the end of that section, if you would.
Okay. He promises to give him morphine and that a nurse will be beside him at all times to hold his hand and talk him through it. It being the transition, the change of state, the fall of light, the trade, the instant of the hand itself turning from the subject into object. No, we are not allowed in the ward, and there cannot be exceptions. Thank you for making this difficult call, but I know what the body wants. Continuance, continuance, continuance at any cost.
And that's a section from the poem Up Late, written by Nick Laird. And as we get Nick in that second section, it almost struck me as if you were writing one thing and you got a slap or a punch in the stomach, if you like, at the news that you received on the phone, and the poem turned in a totally new direction. How did it actually happen in the writing of it?
It's a wee bit of sort of sleight of hand there. You're right, like the poem starts off with all this sort of usual poetry language, I suppose, in some way, and it's a abstract metaphor about the jet of time, and then the real events come in. What happened was my dad was he'd been jabbed. He lived in Cookstown in County Tyrone, and he'd been jabbed with the first thing, and then he was in Lidl, and someone was coughing near him, and the next thing he was very ill with COVID, and then he was in hospital. And we couldn't go in to see him and couldn't even go to his house because it needed to be disinfected. So my mother had died a few years ago in Newry Hospice, and I'd been with her the last few nights, you know, sleeping on a camp bed with her. And I hadn't written about it for weeks afterwards, but because I couldn't be with my dad or see him, I was stuck in my office. So I just kind of wrote through it. And it was, you know, a week, 10 days of just sitting around waiting for news. And then, unfortunately, that day the doctor had rang and said, you know, it's time to let him go.
It's a very, and as you point out in that section that you read for us, Nick, incredibly difficult news to receive, obviously. And yet, did you have the wherewithal to utter those lines? Thank you for making this difficult call.
Yeah. You know, it's just like manners kick in, the kind of the rote way of being in the world kicks in. You kind of watch yourself. Everyone who's experienced that, you know, knows about it. But poetry has always sort of been my way of passing time, so it wasn't that weird for me to be writing all the way through it. It just was weird to be able to, because COVID, that meant, you know, you couldn't be with the person who was ill or dying, so there was nothing else to do.
Yeah, where were you? I mean, your father, I think, he was in hospital in Northern Ireland.
He was in Antrim. I was in London. I've just got back in London now. I have a house in West Cork, and then I've just been up in Tyrone. Took the ferry back on Friday from Dublin to Holyhead. I was clearing out his house, so I'm just back again to London. I've been living in New York for 10 years, but we moved back last year, so that's where I'm at the moment.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the awful reality that you present to us in the poem. You go through it in different ways later on. You mention specifically a nurse by the name of Elizabeth, and you mention a specific doctor later on as well. Those people become, or must have become, so important to you in terms of just disseminating difficult but very important information.
Yeah. I didn't, you know, you're very sort of close to the poem, and half the time you've no idea what the poem is about. It was only a friend of mine, Colm, who's a writer as well, read it and emailed me a couple of days ago, and he'd written this long, intelligent email about what the poem was about, and suddenly I sort of realised myself. He was talking about how it's, you know, about time, basically holding time, trying to obstruct time, keeping time back, giving into time, naming things and people in time. Like the names of Elizabeth and Andrew Black and even my dad's name suddenly seemed important to have them in the poem. So sometimes you don't really know what you're doing until long after the event, I think.
Maybe you'd read a little section that talks about it. This is where you're, I suppose, maybe in reaction to that email, or certainly it seems it to be in direct dialogue with that email, where you're discussing, if you like, what you were hoping the poem might do for yourself. It's this, you know, the section I'm talking about. I want the poem, but I want you to read the line rather than me say it. Go ahead.
Sure. I want the poem to destroy time. What are the ceremonies of forgetting? There is a spring in Boeotia that lets the river Lethe enter the world. King Jucky's ale of forgetfulness, excessive phlegm. But I like the notion of the angel lightly tapping the baby in its soft hollow above the top lip, the raising all the child knows, all its regret, all its terrible grief, before it descends again fresh to the world.
That's Nick Laird reading another section from his poem Up Late, written, I suppose, in some ways, Nick, a way of dealing with the grief of the loss of your father. What I found interesting, particularly in that section, is that you go into, if you like, almost into a mythological world, a world of otherness in some ways. Putting yourself and allowing yourself to travel there as a poet, does that help deal with the awful reality of the real world in front of you, and the awful reality you were dealing with around the time of the death of your father?
I think it does. You know, I sort of, up until maybe, I don't know, my early 30s, I did think of poetry as sort of exploratory, like a way of exploring language and emotions. But certainly, since people I know have started to die, sort of from late 30s onwards, it's become consolatory, you know, a form of consolation. And I do go to it for sort of... I almost like a kind of prayer, saying things over and over again. So I said another part of the poem, you know, about an elegy, I think, is words to bind a grief and the companionship of grief. And since my mother died, and I'd written, it took me a while to write about that, but I'd written about that afterwards. I think poetry is consolation in some way. It's a way of binding the thing up, keeping it safe and so on.
Yeah, and it kind of, I suppose, in some ways, the elegy records this. It writes it down in a way that may not last forever, but certainly it seems to have a kind of a permanence of some kind about it. You mentioned there about the death of your mother, and you talk about your father, in fact, in those terms, how he dealt with that and how he dealt with other difficulties in his own life, and yet finally this COVID came and got him. In the poem itself, do you feel, you mentioned that section you read, what are the ceremonies of forgetting? Was this elegy in some ways the ceremonies that we couldn't attend? Did it provide you with some kind of solace that those normal rituals would give us if we were attending the funeral of a loved one in the normal way? Go ahead.
That was pretty brutal. When my mum died, like, we had a big service in the church and up at Roselawn Crematorium in Belfast, and, you know, there was hundreds of people at the church, and we had a massive wake, you know, and couldn't do anything at all for my dad. It was me and my sister standing in the car park at Roselawn watching a screen. So it was pretty brutal, to be honest. You know, obviously they had the big funeral for Bobby Storey, the IRA guy, but for normal people, it was nothing at all. The undertaker couldn't even tell people he rang up when the coffin was being moved into the hearse to drive up to Belfast. So it felt very lonely and odd, and maybe in some way that was also what necessitated the writing of something sort of, you know, stable and solid and a kind of recording of the moment. Maybe so.
Do you think it provided, you know, any kind of, or what kind of solace, or what kind of processing of the grief did it allow you to do, Nick, or make?
Yeah, I think it did in some way, you know, and I think elegies do. I like poetry that's about big things. I go there when I want to be renewed and think about things seriously. So I would read a lot of, you know, serious poetry, elegies, Heaney's Clearances, Muldoon's Incantata, Murray Howe, Mark Doty, Rilke's Duino elegies. You know, I do go to them for like thinking about some of the serious aspects of life. So,
Would the reading of those poems, you know, poems from other people, would they feed directly into dealing with the death of your father, or indeed your mother, or indeed any loved one that you might have lost along the way? Would the reading feed into that in a different way from the writing of this poem specifically?
It's maybe a hard question. I think you furnish your mind with different people's work over the years, and I suppose whenever it comes to face up to something of your own, you deal with it in one way as a person and maybe in another way as a writer. So some of the stuff I've taken from other writers over the years undoubtedly is sort of fed into this poem, I suppose. But, you know, everyone's grief is personal, really. But maybe it gives you some resilience. And there is a consolation in understanding that other people have felt the same as you.
Yeah. I will finish up by listening to a section of the poem that I particularly, I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but that I felt really touched on something important. But before I do that, you were at the Boris Festival of Writing and Ideas in Carlow. Was that just at the weekend there, along with Zadie Smith, your wife? How different a literary festival did you find yourself attending? You know, obviously the death of your father, and when you even hear the word COVID, that must immediately strike you. But it is a very different world we're living in. How different was that festival in that respect, would you say?
Well, we were outside in tents, you know, kind of open tents. A lot of people had the masks on, but actually the weather was good. So it was very sunny and people were sitting outside. It felt like quite a joyful occasion, maybe because of the sort of freedom of it, but it didn't feel that different to previous years at Boris. I don't know. It felt normal to me.
Ah, good that we might be getting back then to some kind of normality. I should have started by expressing my sympathies to you, Nick, on the loss of your father. Sorry for not doing that a little bit earlier. But perhaps you would finish up with the section about that moment when you phoned the hospital for us from the poem Up Late.
Sure. When I phoned the hospital this afternoon to say goodbye, though you were no longer lucid, Elizabeth, the nurse, held the phone against your ear, and I could hear you breathing, or perhaps the rasping of the oxygen machine. And I said what you'd expect. I love you, Dad, and I want you to keep on fighting. But if you are too tired now and in too much pain, then you should stop fighting and let go. And whatever happens, it's okay. I love you. You were a good father. The kids love you. Thank you for everything. Then I hung up and seen. Impossible to grieve and not know the vanity of grief, to watch oneself perform the rituals that take us. Automaton of grief, I howled, of course, on myself in my office, then sobbed for a bit on the sofa. An elegy, I think, is words to bind a grief in, a companionship of grief, a spell to keep it safe and sound, to keep it from escaping. There are various ways to memorize. Plato calls a mnemosyne. My grandfather Bertie liked to tie a knot in his blue handkerchief. My father wrote in biro on his palm. I cannot leave the poem alone.
Nick Laird with that section from his poem Up Late. Thank you so much for sharing it with us this evening, Nick. And in fact, for people can read the poem in full on granta.com. And let us say your father's name as it is mentioned in the final stanza of the poem. His name was
Alistair Laird.
Well, Alistair Laird, may he rest in peace. And Nick, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this evening.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Alt folk band Moxie released their album The Dawn of Motion on this coming Friday. The album came about when band members Julia Spano and Darren Roach set about playing homage to each other's cultures by combining the Irish jig with intricate rhythms. The band was formed in 2011 but has attracted new members along the way, not least, most recently, vocalist and songwriter Julia Spano, who has French, Vietnamese and Italian roots. With me in studio this evening to talk about what that has done to the Moxie sound are Ted Kelly and Julia Spano of Moxie. But first of all, let's listen to the opening track on the new album. It's called Is Anam Dom. Opening track is Anam Dom from the Dawn of Motion new album from Moxie, which will be released in full this Friday. But delighted to have Julia Spano and Ted Kelly with me in studio this evening to talk a little bit about that. French, Vietnamese and Italian roots is what I'm told, Julia. And definitely in that I hear African rhythms. So there's kind of four traditions really within you, is there?
Yes, absolutely. I grew up in Tunisia. I was born there and I left when I was 18. So this is definitely a big part of my heritage.
Mm. How many languages, I was asking how many do I hear on that song, first of all, but how many languages do I hear on the album?
So on the album, you can hear three different languages, English, Irish and Arabic.
English. So Arabic is the other, is the language that you would use mostly as another mode of expression, is it really?
I wouldn't say that the language is the main thing that I use. I would use probably more the techniques of Arabic singing. But yeah, Arabic is only featuring on Is Anam Dom, the album.
All right. So, and when you say the techniques of Arabic singing, is that the kind of vocalese, that kind of high...
Exactly,
waving sound. Waving isn't quite the right word, but it's kind of undulating sound that really brings a kind of eeriness almost to the tune.
Yes, exactly. That's something you can call melisma. It's a singing technique that when you sing, it's the ability to sing one syllable,
yes,
and multiple notes within that syllable.
Yes,
basically.
Yeah. So it's like it's one big long sound, but it's over several notes, so it's
exactly
moving around in pitch. So Ted, obviously, Julia, I was asking you again as we were listening to the track, came to the band, I think you said maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
What difference do you think that has brought? I've always loved what you guys do in terms of the energy and this your get out there quality that you bring to the music. What do you think Julia has brought to the band?
I think it really gives the music a lead, you know, like we never had a vocalist. We were always an instrumental band before. And I suppose as we got a bit older, we got more and more interested in songs, but we didn't really expect to have met Julia, but when we did meet her and we heard her sing, we said, well, do you want to come in and play with us for a while? And here we are now, 3 years later, with a full album ready to go. So,
and how would you say, I mean, what is the cultural exchange or interchange, if you like? How does it work? Do you find yourself trying to balance things up, saying, oh, well, let's have a little bit more of us, or let's have a little bit more of Julia in there? How does that balance work itself through?
Well, even in the instrumental tracks, like on some of them, Julia is actually using her voice as an instrument. So she's singing along with accordions and electric guitars and banjos.
That melismatic
Yeah, exactly. Or even sometimes like in the production of it, we put Julia's voice in the back like a pad to warm up things and to create atmospheres, you know, in the music.
What did you know of Moxie when you came to the band first, Julia?
Well, I had been to a few gigs already and I was very good friends with all the members of the band, so they showed me a lot about Irish culture and Irish traditional music, because they took me around to Irish festivals and like I yeah, they made my culture, really, like, you know, and that's how I guess I was ready. As soon as I joined the band full time, I was ready to understand their style and their identity in order to be able to add a bit of my character into it.
But you were coming to a well-oiled machine,
yes,
and you know, a group that really had a real synergy that worked very well together. Did you have to headbutt your way in, or did the waters gently part for you to make your way in?
That's very interesting. I guess it all happened very naturally, as like I hadn't really, like, I was never a performer before that, never considered myself as a professional singer or anything. Do you know, they gave me that chance, that opportunity to just go on stage with them, to write with them, and that meant so much to me that I felt like I had to keep up the level, do you know, and yeah, it all was so natural and smooth, really.
And Ted, you were saying to me there, you know, as well, about the importance of tradition. That is there, but there's more to it than saying, oh, let's just have something stick with the tradition and not do anything with it. What do you feel is the importance of what you're doing in terms of, honouring the tradition but moving things on?
I guess, like, we've always been interested in creating music that speaks for people today, you know, and especially because we grew up with traditional music ingrained in us, all the rest of the band. When we met Julia, we were just so open to trying to understand other traditions as well and bring modernity into the music and create music and songs that really speak about the now and the multiculturalism that we have in this country as well, you know.
I know this is the who can answer this question. Are you hoping that there might be, because I can only imagine what this would be like live, in a live situation. I mean, an album is one thing where you've got all the accoutrements of the studio behind you and you can, we can do that again, or we can warm that up this way. A live situation is both exciting and frightening. Are you working towards live performances? What way are you handling that?
Yeah, we have some gigs coming up actually, and we've been working on the production of the live production over the lockdown, you know. So we are playing in Doolin on the 3rd of September. We're playing in Claremorris at the Folk Festival on the 4th of September. And then we're down in Dingle at Ontubbin on the 5th of December.
And so as far as you're concerned, now I know you are waiting on all sorts of announcements and that. And, you know, we're hearing today that maybe October might be a possibility. You'll just doctor the gig to whatever the rules are at the time. Is that the way of it?
Yeah, most of these gigs are going to be outside. So
right.
We're allowed to have a certain amount of people at all of them. I think it varies from venue to venue. So if you do want to come to any of those gigs, you better get some tickets quick.
Yeah, good to get that in. Very important. Got to get the plug. And for you, Julia, have there been live performances with, you know, the kind of Moxie, the Mad Moxie crowd in front of you? Have you had any of that? Have you had that experience yet?
You mean as part of the audience?
Yeah, no, as you up, down, looking at the Mad, rather than being part of the Mad Moxie crowd in the audience, you know, being up there on stage looking down at them.
Well, I just performed a show in Waterford. The last gig was yesterday. It's called Prism. And the boys didn't really get the opportunity to come, but Ted was there yesterday. And yeah, I guess for the first time I was there on stage and with other performers, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, but I'm guessing that being there with Moxie is going to be on stage with Moxie themselves is going to be a whole new level on that. The new single, The Place Above, is that what we're talking? Tell me a little bit about this, or who's best to tell me?
Julia's definitely best to talk about this one.
You're, in terms of the vocal songs, are you doing the writing there, Julia?
Yes, absolutely. Well, for some of them, we're collaborating, and but for this one, I wrote the lyrics. So the general theme of the song is about belonging and about really chasing a dream and keeping your faith when it comes to finding the right place at the right time, where you'd be fulfilled and you'd be able to achieve your dreams.
Well, you've certainly created an interesting new space between all of you, not just the two of you, because of the other members of the band as well, Ted. There are kind of almost two albums in here. There's what I would recognise as the Moxie I know from the past, and then Julia brings almost at times, I would say, an R&B feel to it. Would you accept that? Disco feel, pop feel?
Absolutely, yeah. Like I think Julia's voice lends itself greatly to pop music and and R&B, like you're talking about, it's very smooth and it sounds great. So for me anyway, so like we're quite interested though in all types of music, you know, like our album is about not just traditional music, but it's about us creating our own music that makes us feel like, you know, we are the today of this country.
Fair enough. I know, you know, there's only two types of music, they say anyway, good and bad.
Exactly.
So I presume it's the good stuff, it's the good stuff that you're looking for. Let's have a listen then to the new single, The Place Above, from Moxie. Looking up, always stepping towards where I'm supposed to be, dreaming of what my eyes could see. Tired of living on the edge and longing to feel free. Someday that's certainly on the poppier side of the album, new album from Moxie. The new album is called The Dawn of Motion. The song that we just heard called The Place Above. It's released this Friday. And as Ted was telling us there, they'll be playing at Doolin in a hotel in Clare that night. They'll be playing Clare Morris Folk Festival on Saturday. And further information on dates into the winter on moxiemuso.com. M-O-X-I-E-M-U-S-O. moxiemuso.com. Now on at the Abbey Theatre, Walls and Windows is the tale of John and Julia, a traveller couple whose lives begin to fall apart when they are moved on from their halting site by the local council. Directed by Jason Byrne, Rosine McDonagh makes her debut with a full-length play, and indeed it's the first time for the National Theatre to produce a play by a traveller writer. John Connors plays John, Sirica Fox plays Julia in the online version, which is available until 11th of September, while Sarah Morris took on the role live on stage last week. Chris Mornish has been to see the live version and he's with me in studio this evening. We'll come back to the Sirica Sarah aspect of things in a minute, Chris. But the big moment here is really traveller culture being represented in this way by a play written by a woman from the travelling community on the stage of the National Theatre. This is a big moment.
This is a big moment because there have been a lot of plays in Irish theatre in which we have travellers. You know, you go back to John Millington Sings, The Tinker's Wedding, think of a play like Sive with character like Pats Bocock or Carthalon. And they've always been there really to do something, to tell us something about the settled culture. It's never really been about the traveller culture. So this is really the first time we've seen, you know, an important part of Irish culture on the stage of the National Theatre. And it is ruthlessly unsentimental. You know, you feel the pain of these characters and you feel the pain of the prejudice that they have felt in their lives, but it doesn't sentimentalize them. And it makes you realize how many of the travelers we have seen in Irish theatre up until now have really been very much sentimentalized versions.
Or certainly versions written from the outside, whereas this Absolutely. Quite definitely is a traveler's story written from the inside, yes. From Rosie McDonagh. Essentially, it's the story of a couple.
Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah, John and Julia, who, as you said in the intro, they live on a halting site and they've been evicted from the halting site. So they move into a house and they're unable to keep up the rent and they end up losing the house as well. Basically, it tears them apart. Yeah. I mean, it destroys him. She ends up in homeless accommodation, addicted to alcohol.
Yeah, what's interesting about this couple is they're kind of, even within their own culture, like any culture, I suppose, mm-hmm. in some ways, they're kind of fighting against, lots of people are down on top of them, if you like, and they're fighting against the status quo to kind of be who they want to be, no matter what anybody else thinks.
There's a beautiful moment at the end of the play where John Connor's character, John, he has a monologue. And you just have, you know, he's talking about a life in free fall. And you realize what a life in free fall is like when there is literally nobody to catch you. And that sense of having the whole society on top of you just comes across really, really powerfully in that monologue.
The other thing that struck me, I saw the part of the online version of the play, and what really struck me, which I can only imagine what it was like in the theatre itself, was the set. This is It really brings you to a place that maybe you're not used to being brought to in terms of theatre.
Yeah, Joanna Parker's set is brilliant, really, really smart. Basically, what you have on stage is a traveller caravan made out of a sort of like a frame. So it's somewhere between a frame and a cage, which is a lovely sort of metaphor in its own right. But it comes apart. So you have a play about a family whose home is broken up, whose lives are broken up, and the set literally breaks up. So, you know, part of it becomes the hotel that's the homeless accommodation, part of it becomes something else. And I just love sets that are simple and smart. And this is a simple, smart set.
And I guess that's there in the title of the play as well. I mean, walls do two things. They they close us in, but they also protect us. Yeah. Windows let us see out. They let people see in. They also allow people to maybe make judgment from the other side of a window. There's all sorts of lovely metaphors going on there in that choice of title from Rosalind
McDonagh.
Very
nice things going on there, yeah. And at a certain point in the play, they use the door, like the door of the caravan, as this thing that's being fought over between the guards who are trying to evict them from the site and the travellers who are trying to stay on the site. And you realise it's shaped like a riot shield. It's shaped like a door. It becomes this object that's kind of pushed back and forth. You know, yeah, uses the set in really, really smart ways.
But we should talk a little bit more about the writer well, Rosalind McDonagh, and what she has achieved in terms of her writing to date. She also has a memoir out at the moment, Unsettled, which again, very clever title.
Yeah.
What do you think she brings to the table as a writer here?
Well, I mean, she's a remarkable individual. I mean, she's a traveller woman. She's been an advocate for traveller rights for a long time. She has cerebral palsy, so I mean, she's a wheelchair user. She has 3 degrees from my own institution, Trinity. She has an undergraduate degree, 2 master's degrees, and she has a PhD, not from Trinity. And, you know, so she's accomplished a lot in her life. And because of her situation, she has a very finely attuned sense of, if you like, intersectional prejudice. That is not just being a woman, it's not just being a traveler, it's not just being somebody who uses a wheelchair. It's when all three of those things intersect. What does that mean? And she's very articulate about it.
Yeah, and in fact, because the couple have a child, don't they, who is in a wheelchair
that's
as well.
Right.
That's an interesting aspect that she's brought in there. Yeah, How is that explored in terms of John and Julius' son, isn't it? It's a son who's in a wheelchair, is it?
Yeah, you don't actually see this character. So it's just something spoken about in the play, yeah. So it's there. There's also a character in the play who's gay, who doesn't want to be married in the kind of arranged marriage, and it turns out because she's in love with another woman. So she's bringing in a whole lot of other, you know, things into the situation.
Well, let's listen to a scene actually from very early on, which gives us a hint of that character you've just spoken about, Charlene, played here by Hazel Clifford, and Julia. This is the online version that we have the clip from. So the Julia here is played by Soraka Fox. From the beginning, first scene of Rosalind McDonagh's play, Walls and Windows.
When John told me you were doing an exam in the morning and the wedding, I thought it didn't sound right, but it's great. Do any of the settled ones from school, do they know?
Oh, they've been asking me about marriage since first year.
You loved the school. I was never any good at it. Never had a chance, I suppose. Teachers and them days. Me boys, hopefully they love school the way you do.
Oh, things haven't changed that much. It was up to me to show them they didn't expect much. Getting married and doing exams. My dream is to go to college. How do you know? How do you know you love John?
Very big question indeed there from the character of Charlene, played by Hazel Clifford, and the other actor in the scene, Soraka Fox, playing the character of Julia from Walls and Windows. Chris Morrish went to see the production in the Abbey Theatre. That's the online version, Chris, as I said, and it's Soraka Fox on the online version. Soraka Fox and that character, Julia, is hugely important because essentially it's the dynamic between John and Julia that we're really looking at in this play.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I mean, quite a task then for the actor for Sarah Morris, who had to take over.
Yeah, I saw it on Thursday night, and she'd been at it for like a grand total of 2 days. She had to take over on basically an opening night, and so she was still partly on book when I saw her. Mm. But the amazing thing was she'd been at it for 2 days, and she had 3, maybe 4 scenes down already. There's a kind of heroism in actors that I just admire and have to applaud. And that was, there was a kind of heroism in that, taking that over. And yeah, so she moved into the role for the live performance last week. But for people who watch the on demand this week, it's Circa Fox.
Circa Fox. Yeah. And indeed, I mean, it is a performance, and it is a character that is so central to the to the whole story that's been told here. There is a lot of stuff. There are a lot of issues that are put in front of us.
Yeah, there's that scene that we heard there at the start. I kind of wondered, did it need to be there myself? What Rosaline does is something quite ambitious in that she tells a story of a family breaking up with a narrative that's also broken up.
So we don't get, it's not a linear tale.
It's not beginning, middle, end. Yeah. In order to do, I mean, that's great. And that could be a really powerful way of telling a story. In order to do that, though, you sometimes have to give your audience something to hang on to at the start. And what we get at the start is this scene that we just heard there with the character Charlene, who doesn't actually really appear again. So it's, I kind of thought there was perhaps scope there to tighten up the narrative a bit. But that's a kind of dramaturgical thing, really.
Yeah, so it was at the point maybe of a little bit earlier on. And this was a play that was commissioned by the outgoing directors of the Abbey, Graham McLaren and Neil Murray.
Yeah.
And it came, in fact, from their short sections that the Dear Ireland
That's right. project
that they had.
Yeah, I mean, which was that wonderful project they did, you know, in the kind of the first shock of lockdown of you know, suddenly actors having, you know, nothing. Mm. And they did, I mean, I forget how many they did. I mean, they did dozens of them.
Yes.
And they got Rosaline to do one, and they saw hers, and they thought, okay, this we want something more here. And they've got it.
And developed, and to get that first traveller's writing voice onto the stage of National Theatre, that in itself is laudable.
It is. And I mean, this is an important play. This is a play that people will go back to and will write about and think about. And again, it's like, you know, 50 people in the audience. You just, you know, because of the COVID restrictions, you just wish this could have been a play with a full house on an opening night, because this is an event. You know, this is an event in the history of the theatre. It should, you know, you just wish it had been that full house.
That it does deserve that. Performers that you would, or would you single any particular performance out?
I think, I mean, for me, I mean, Sarah Morris, just, you take your hat off. That's heroic acting.
Yeah, she stepped into the breach.
Yeah. It's a strong cast. John Connors really stands out. There's a scene at the end where he has a monologue, and he just digs deep for that. And it's just him alone on a stage.
Who people will know, of course, from Cardboard Gangsters and Love Hate. Gangsters, rather, and Love Hate in particular.
Yeah. Powerful actor. And I mean, there's a real presence there. Yeah, no, I mean, he'd be my standout actor, yeah.
Yeah. And overall, then, did the production and direction by Jason Bourne of Rosalind McDonagh's play, did it work for you, Chris?
Yeah, overall, as I say, I think there's probably a little bit of tightening up that could be done in terms of the narrative, but the overall seeing the story told that in a way that you had not seen before made you realize you're here at something important. It's well worth seeing.
Let's hope that it will get a chance to get the bigger audience, and that those bigger audiences might be coming our way sooner rather than later. Chris Morris speaking to us there about Rosalind McDonagh's play, Walls and Windows. It's available online. That's the version with Circa Fox until the 11th of September. You can find out full details on abbeytheatre.ie. Halsey, the singer-songwriter from New Jersey, has just released not only a new album, but an accompanying hour-long IMAX film, If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power. Halsey, who was pregnant with their first child at the time of filming, gives us a mythical, historical exploration of motherhood. And in the film, Halsey plays the mythical queen, Leela, the victim of an abusive king and others at the royal court, while the album sees Halsey collaborate for the first time with Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Joining me now is Louise Bruton, who has seen both the film and been listening to the album. Before we move on to the double release of If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power, tell us a little bit about Halsey and her or their career to date.
Yeah, so Halsey, she's switching between the she and their pronouns. And this is her fourth album, and she's a darker pop star. There's always like a dark streak that kind of runs through her music. And she once said before that she's the three B's. She's biracial, bipolar, and bisexual. So she goes for sort of shocking tactics to get her point and her music across. And previously a lot of her music has kind of felt like an endless stream of consciousness with someone who has a lot to say but with no self-edit button. And that has kind of thankfully toned down a bit in this album because she's honed in on just the themes of motherhood and pregnancy, which she has just recently gone through, which kind of has made sure that the album is a lot better than what she's released before.
And how separate would you say the album is from the film? The film which was made, filmed at the Met in New York with Halsey dressed in these historical and mythical costumes with the central characters that she plays all being pregnant.
Well, I saw the film before the album came out. So the album, the film was only released on August 25th and August 26th. They were the only 2 days that the film has been seen across the world in IMAX films. And we only had like a couple of singles out before that point. Mm. And I was sitting through this movie being like, what the hell is going on here? A lot of the film is inspired by Game of Thrones. But she also borrows a lot of visuals with absolutely anything that's related to royalty and castles, such as like Frozen, The Favourite, or Marie Antoinette. And there was even a little glimmer of The Little Mermaid there. And it usually when an album accompanies, comes with a film, the film is like a concert film or it's an extended music video. But this just seemed to be kind of grandiose scenes that would flip between being in the castle, being the virginal queen in the castle, to turning into the drunken harlot, parting and carousing her way through grief until she discovers that she's pregnant. And there wasn't much music in it whatsoever. It was maybe like 2 or 3 songs maybe dominated the whole film. So it just seemed like they had 2 big ideas and then they're like, we need to fill a full concert film with this, and it didn't really go anywhere.
But isn't a part of her, I suppose, her videography, if you like, her what she does with her videos, she likes to push the boundaries a little bit here and certainly likes to be risque.
Well, the only way in which she probably pushed the boundary was that there was full nudity in parts, and we saw her full pregnant body as it actually moved through her actual different stages of pregnancy. So you saw 3 months, 4 months, kind of 8 months and 9 months. And that the nudity worked in parts, but then obviously it was kind of used just as that kind of shock factor. And yeah, it didn't really kind of bring a lot to it, and it just added to the overall confusing plot line. I use plot line very loosely here, of the whole film, because when it all ended, I think the 10 people that were in the cinema just kind of turned around going, what did we just witness here?
Right, okay. Well, I think I know where you stand on the film from what you're saying there. Let's have a listen to a little bit of the music then and see where you are on that particular aspect of things. This is a track called You Asked for This, and some explicit lyrics involved here. Bit of a track there called You Asked for This from Halsey and the new album If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power. Louise Bruton has seen the accompanying IMAX film and has made it clear that she's not a fan of that. That didn't sound in any way obscure in terms of musicality, or certainly in terms of music genre to me. Louise, did you get on better with the album than you did with the film?
Hearing the album after seeing the film was just a total surprise, because This album is fantastic. It has got that kind of grungier, kind of not 90s rock sound, and that's all thanks to the production from Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who are both now members of Nine Inch Nails and have also done the film scores for The Social Network and Gone Girl and a huge amount. So this is basically a Nine Inch Nails pop record, and it brilliantly kind of allows the sort of devastation of Halsey's experience with pregnancy and childbirth and kind of motherhood and misogyny within all of that. And it really darkens her experience, but it feels it's a very enjoyable musical experience, because you're going along with the contrast of her vocals and her very definitive pop voice, And you will actually be thrown back to a lot of the distinctive Nine Inch Nails sounds. Particularly, there's one song called Whispers, and that could have featured on the Downward Spiral, which is the 1994 album by Nine Inch Nails. And it really, like, it moves past that point as well. You're not feeling like it's her jumping on top of their old sound, because there's a fantastic song called I Am Not a Woman, I'm a God, and it's an R&B industrial track, and it really... It, like, I've heard it kind of on 2FM recently, and it really fits in perfectly with the current landscape of pop, but it has got this unique kind of rawness to it that we haven't necessarily heard a lot in pop music lately. Even with Billie Eilish, who is doing kind of raw pop music, but it hasn't really reached this level.
Yeah, well, let's have a little listen to a little bit of I Am Not a Woman, I'm a God. I'm Not a Woman, I'm a God from Halsey and the new album that Louise Bruton has been listening to and he is speaking to us about this evening. Just in terms of, you were saying, seeing or listening to the album after watching the film, it was a totally different world. Did it elucidate the film in any way for you, Louise? Did you find something that perhaps, if you'd listened to the album first, would the film have been different?
No, I think the album and the film were just two completely different concepts. And I think this is a trend that we're going to see for the foreseeable when world tours and concerts are kind of slowed down or condensed, where a lot of labels will probably have money and they're going to invest in kind of these kind of concert films, or they're going to invest in kind of feature length videos. Like we've Kacey Musgraves next week, who's got an album coming out called Starcrossed. And to go with that, she's releasing a 50-minute film on through Paramount, I believe. So it just seems like they all have this budget to have to run through. So it's kind of like an expensive waste of time just so that they can do the end of
year finances. I presume you wouldn't say Queen Bee and Lemonade from Beyonce was an expensive waste of time. Is there a good reason to do these films accompanying albums? Or maybe you would say that was a waste of time. I don't know.
Well, with Beyonce, with when you watched the Lemonade film that went with the album, you were suddenly given this additional kind of historical black culture and black music and black fashion. You were brought into a world and kind of the historic path that Beyonce was like examining and studying at that point. And the same with Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer. She released a 46-minute film that went with that. And each song got its own specific video treatment, whereas with Halsey, there weren't individual video treatments. Like, there was incredible choreography and the outfits were incredible. The dialogue was pretty shabby, but one big bit that you do notice is that the makeup is fantastic in it, and it turns out that Halsey actually did all of her makeup in the film because she has her own makeup line called About Face. So it felt a little bit like it was one big marketing ploy for her makeup, and it worked because she looked great.
Okay, but what you're saying to us is don't be worrying about the film, go out and get the album.
Oh, yeah, well, sure, the film isn't in cinemas anymore, so yeah.
You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
But the album, well worth having a listen to, yeah?
Yeah, and it becomes richer on listen with each listen as well. It's an interesting turn, and I'm kind of interested in this, the old kind of rock gods kind of coming back with the newer kind of pop generation. It's an interesting contrast.
All right. Easier Than Lying is the track we'll finish up with.
My heart is massive, but it's empty. A permanent thought of me that innocent arteries gasping for some real attention. Some undivided hypertension. Tell it quiet down, you're being loud, but it beats harder every time you come around. But do you love the sound?
Easier Than Lying, the title of the track there from the album If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power from Halsey. Louise Bruton talking to us about that. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was in sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Back with you tomorrow night at 7.